Good morning. We are in Luke chapter 16. We're moving along, just 9 chapters left in the 24 chapters of Luke's gospel. And last week, as I said at the beginning of last week, was probably my favorite passage in the whole Bible in many ways. Certainly the center point in Luke's gospel, the great parable of the prodigal son that sort of epitomizes who God is and what his mission is in the world and how we are to interact. We see the characters in that parable, the character of the father who is loving and caring and longing for his children to be in relationship with him. The parable of the prodigal son who wanders off, who represents all of us, those who are all sinners who wander away from God, who are welcomed back into his arms. And then, of course, the older brother who has a self-righteous attitude, who's not interested in reaching out, who wants to stay within his clique and enjoy the blessings that God has given him because he is so special, instead of a vision for outreach. And we see how we play each of those characters different times in our lives, where we are the prodigal who wanders away from God, where we represent God to the world, where we are the one welcoming back lost people. And sometimes, though, in hypocrisy, we play the part of the older brother, where we look down on people and we refuse to love them with the same kind of self-sacrificial and unconditional love that God has. So it's just an amazing passage that lifts us up and gives us sort of the big picture. You know, it's what we call a little gospel within the gospel. We've got 4 long gospels, 4 New Testament stories of Jesus, but here's one little story that sort of epitomizes the whole gospel message and epitomizes, in many ways, the whole of the Bible, because the Bible is all about the story of God seeking and saving his lost children, bringing them back into relationship with him. So that was last week, the parable of the prodigal son. From the parable of the prodigal son, though, immediately in Luke, the Bible is so great, because immediately in Luke, you plunge into what is one of the most bizarre parables Jesus has ever told, the strangest parables Jesus has ever told. It's one of those we often skip over. I don't think until I was teaching through Luke's gospel, teaching every single passage, I'd ever taught this, certainly. I'd never even heard it taught or preached in a sermon, because it is kind of a bizarre parable. If I were to ask you, what are the greatest of Christian virtues? What are the greatest of Christian virtues? What would you say are the greatest of Christian virtues? Love, okay? Love. The greatest of these is love. Paul says that explicitly in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. What else? Forgiveness. That's a great trait that reflects God's love and God's willingness to forgive. What else? Honesty. Okay, honesty, or focus on truth. Excellent. Yeah, what else? Grace. Okay, God's great grace, self-sacrificial giving. We said love. What are the other 2 great Christian virtues that go along with love all the time? Faith and hope. Faith, hope, and love. So those are the kinds of things we think of. Joy. Right? Christian joy. We think of long-suffering. We think of patience. In fact, those fruit of the Spirit that Paul gives us in Galatians, love, joy, peace, patience, long-suffering, those are the things we think of as the great Christian virtues. We don't usually think of a great Christian virtue as greed, you know? Right? Such a Christian thing, you know, greed. Or dishonesty. Dishonesty. Or manipulation. Or being shrewd or cunning. Those are not exactly the characteristics that we normally identify with key Christian virtues. You know, get a book on Christian virtues, it doesn't start off with greed and move on to dishonesty, you know, and then cunning manipulation. Yet in Luke chapter 16, Jesus tells a parable where a particular steward or manager displays, apparently, some of those very traits. And Jesus actually ends the parable by commending this particular individual. It's one of the most strange parables Jesus tells, especially we think, first of all, why did he tell it? And then we wonder, what point could he possibly bring from this parable? So here it is. Here's my title I gave it to it. Life's Lessons from a Real Jerk. All right? How's that? Life's Lessons from a Real Jerk, the parable of the shrewd manager. Before I read the parable, let me give you a little bit of background and culture and context. Not at all surprising, wealthy individuals in the ancient world would often have managers or chief stewards to oversee, to handle their business affairs. Something like a CEO. He'd be the owner of the corporation, but he wasn't hands-on. People get really wealthy, they don't want to be working too much. They want someone else to do their work for them. And so a CEO or maybe a CFO, a chief financial officer, this person may be a wealthy landowner, and this manager manages all of the tenant farmers. That is, this happened a lot in Galilee, by the way. In the north of Galilee, much of the land was owned by Gentiles, actually, and they would hire local peasant farmers to farm it. Well, this manager may be managing those affairs. Or the owner could be just a nobleman, a wealthy nobleman who has lots and lots of business people, merchants and so forth, working for him. And he's got one particular manager who manages all of these people who work for him. This guy essentially owns a conglomerate, okay, a multinational corporation. And this is his chief CEO, his chief manager in the situation. So let's look at the parable. Here it is. It's Luke chapter 16. I'll read through the parable, then we'll zero in on each individual sentence and phrase. Jesus told his disciples, this is Luke 16, verse 1. Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer. The manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their homes. So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. Then he asked the second, how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. Okay, now there's the parable. We'll go then further into the teaching in a minute. Let's look at the basics of the parable. It comes to the owner's attention that the manager is squandering or wasting his money, his resources. You know, he's using the resources of the business for his own benefit. Maybe it's those two-hour lunches. You know, he goes and he takes the credit card and he spends hours and hours whining and dining during his lunch or even in the evening. Or maybe he takes business trips to Tahiti and spends gobs of the owner's money on that. Or he goes golfing with so-called clients, all of his buddies, all of his cronies, three times a week. He goes golfing. He's got a couple of corporation company cars. There's the Lamborghini, of course, and the two Mercedes, and then the Rolls Royce. And the owner starts noticing this. Does this sound like the government, by the way? The manager the owner starts to notice this, and he says, what's going on? So he calls them in. He says, you know, tell me about the Lamborghini in your driveway. And what about that Learjet I just saw parked down the street? I don't see that as really necessary for the corporation. And so he says, what's going on? And he fires the guy from this position. He says, you will not be my manager any longer. So the manager has a dilemma. He is in a pickle. Verse 3, the manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master has taken away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. There's two things he doesn't want to do. He doesn't want to dig. In other words, he says, okay, I have been a manager all of my life. I get my fingernails manicured every week. For me to start digging, this guy probably had never done an honest day's labor in his life. You know, well, managing, I better be careful. I'll insult a lot of managers in the audience. He had not done any manual labor in his life. And he goes, I'm too old for that. I'll kill myself if I go out to dig. So he can't possibly do that. And he says, and I'm too proud. I'm ashamed to beg. These are really the two options he has left. Why is that? Well, he's got a soiled reputation. You know, he's lost all credibility in the community. Everyone in a community like this, everyone would know everything. And they would know that this guy had absconded with his master's property. This guy was not a good manager. So he's not exactly going to move horizontally. You know, there's not going to be a lot of headhunters out there looking to hire this guy. So he says, oh no, I've lost any possibility to serve as a manager anymore. I've learned my CEO days are over. My CFO days are over. But I don't want to dig. I'll go into an early grave. There's a pun there somewhere, I think, if you dig. And I'm too proud to beg. Begging was viewed negatively in Judaism for the most part, even though giving to almsgiving was highly valued. I sometimes draw on this passage or this book. This book is called Sirach. It's also called Ecclesiasticus. It really encapsulates a lot of the Jewish wisdom of the day. And here's something from the wisdom of Ben Sirach. It says, my child, do not lead the life of a beggar. It's better to die than to beg. Now, there's sort of popular wisdom that it would be a very shameful thing for this man. We don't know about his family, but it would be certainly shameful for his family. So what's he going to do? He's got this dilemma. So he starts to think and to scheme, and I think that's what we can call it. And he thinks, I know what I'll do. When I lose my job here, verse 4, people will welcome me into their homes or into their houses. He says, what can I do to make friends with people so that if I have no income of my own, at least I will receive hospitality that will keep me alive, that will take care of me. So here's the manager's solution. Look at verse 5. So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. Now that may be because, like I said, he's a tenant farmer. Maybe he farms olive trees, and so he owes him. This is the percentage he owes the owner of that. Or he could be a merchant, and this just happens to be the debt he owes. So he owes him 800 gallons of olive oil. That would be worth about 1,000 denarii. That clears it up, doesn't it? A denarius was worth about a day's labor for a day laborer, for a worker. So I don't know, depending on what a worker would earn, $50. I don't know what someone working outside would earn today. Think of that as a denarius. So this was 1,000 times that. So this is like 3 years worth of work for a regular day laborer. Well, the manager has the solution. He says, make it 400. Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. Second guy comes in. That was the olive oil. And he says, and how much do you owe? And the answer is 1,000 bushels of wheat. That's worth about 2,500 denarii. And so that's even longer, 10 years, something like that. So we're talking about a lot of money for a day laborer here. He told them, take your bill and make it 800. So the first one he cuts in half. The second one he cuts by 20%. Now, curiously, both of those come to about a cut of about 500 denarii. So it's about the same, but it's about 2.5 years worth of work. So this is a huge, huge reduction in what they owe the master. So what's going to happen? You see what he's done? He's called them in. He's canceled the debt, essentially, or a big chunk of the debt. How is the master going to respond? Well, what we expect is the master finds out, and what does he do? That's right. Yeah, he gets him, he arrests him, he throws him in prison, or he just cuts his head off, you know, makes a nice quick solution. We expect to hear the master came in and chopped his head off. And then Jesus would have a great application. This is the way I would have written it. He would have said, and so will it be, right? So will it be for every one of you who cheats God. I like that one, right? The offering, Dennis just mentioned the offering. It's right over here, okay? So don't be sure before you leave to make your way over there. Yeah. That's the way I would have ended the parable, you know? Don't be like the shrewd manager. don't be dishonest, because God knows, God sees all things. Now, there are some stories that go something like that. That's not the way this one ends. Jesus says the master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. He commended, Jesus not only doesn't condemn him, he presents him as a model in some way for us to follow. Now that's a little bit bizarre, don't you think? That's a little bit strange. This is the parable of the strange incident with the shrewd manager. That's what we could call this parable. What in the world is going on here? Now, interpreters, if you look in your commentaries, always try to explain it away a little bit, and so we'll look at some of those possible solutions, but I think when it comes down to it, it's still strange. But what Jesus does, Jesus is a master teacher. He takes a story and then he finds application from it. Good preachers can do this. You know, they can take almost any story at all and they can find something in that story that we really can connect to and apply to our lives. And Jesus does an amazing job. Fortunately for us, when he finishes the parable, he goes right into teaching. And the teaching responds, I think, directly to the points in that parable. But first of all, let's look at some of the various possible interpretations of what's going on. Well, the first one seems to be the most obvious, and the one that just on face value seems to be it. He's cheating the master to make friends of the clients, right? In other words, he doesn't care. The master's already fired him. What worse can he do? Well, he could come after him, of course, but he's going to make friends of these clients so that they will go, "This guy really took care of me." I mean, those are huge debts. These people could well have been in trouble financially. They might have been in danger of losing their homes or, you know, being ruined financially. And here this steward comes along, this manager comes along, and he saves them. He delivers them from this terrible, terrible debt. So he's thinking probably, I can cheat my master and get away with it. Now, why doesn't the master just go and take the money back? Why doesn't he go and say, you've got to bring back that olive oil? Well, no doubt, the manager said, the master has allowed me to do this, or we've decided this is our advertising campaign, 50% off this week only. You know, this is a big sale. We've decided we're going to reduce your debt. Or the way short sales in houses, you know how these go, how, you know, we want to get something from you. It's a bad economy, so we are going to cut your debt in half. We can pay off that credit card in half the time. So he well could be doing that. And the owner now, these debts have been forgiven. What would happen if the owner said, no, not really? What that would do, that would bring incredible shame on the owner. And this is a culture, we've talked about this quite a lot. The culture of the Middle East in the first century was a culture of honor and shame. I'm sure, you know, the reputation of the owner has already gone out. Everyone's talking about how wonderful he is, how he's you know, this incentive program has spurred the economy forward. He's forgiven all these debts. That sounds familiar too, doesn't it? And the economy is going to get rolling. Everyone loves him now. And he goes, actually, we're not going to do it after all. That would just be awful. So probably it would cause too much shame to do this. So he's got to go along with it. He's got to move forward. So that's one possibility. Here's another possibility, is that the manager is removing illegal interest that the master had earlier imposed. Now, this is one of my favorites, even though I don't know if it's true or not. In Israel, it was against the law, the Old Testament law, the law of Moses, to charge interest on a fellow Israelite. The Old Testament law forbade, do we use that anymore? I typed in forbade and I thought, forbade? That just sounds so weird. We don't use forbid much anymore. Anyway, but the Old Testament forbid interest. Let me show you a passage here. This is Exodus 22:25. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you shall not deal with them as a creditor. You shall not exact interest from them. So the Old Testament commanded people not to charge interest to their fellow Israelites. Now there was a reason for this. Is who has the money to lend? The rich have the money to lend. And when you lend to a poor person, the poor person goes into debt. And there's a tendency, and we've seen this in countries, Grapes of Wrath. You ever see the Grapes of Wrath? You see this where basically wealthy landowners can really extort or even take such advantage of the poor that the poor get poorer and poorer and poorer and the rich just get richer and richer because they control all of the financial resources. So God said, that's not going to happen among my people. That's not going to happen among my people. You must lend, but you must not lend with credit. You must not push them further into poverty. Now, this is actually a great verse to do what we call hermeneutics, to do how do we read and study the Bible? Because some people read that and go, okay, Christians cannot charge interest. How many of you have a loan on your home? Right? How many of you have a mortgage? Sorry, you're going to have to get rid of that. Right? No, you're not allowed to pay interest. You're not allowed to charge interest. So obviously, we read that this law was given to whom? It's given to Israel in the Old Testament, and it was given in a particular social and cultural context. Did you know that? Not every command in the Bible was meant for you. If it was, all of you wearing clothing with cotton polyester blend would be in trouble. Because did you know the Old Testament expressly forbids people to wear clothing made of more than one material? Expressly forbids that. Anyone have any shellfish this week? Right? Scallops? Or lobster. The Old Testament expressly forbids the eating of that. How about bacon this morning? The Old Testament expressly forbids the eating of pork. Those were commands given to Israel in the Old Testament. Fortunately, they're not repeated in the New Testament, so we can have bacon. We can have scallops wrapped in bacon, even. That's particularly good. Tasty, right? I think I used that one when I did my parable of the great banquet or something there. Yeah. Yeah, I've totally lost my thought. All I'm thinking about is scallops wrapped in bacon. So the point here is that not every command in the Old Testament was meant for us. These commands were meant for Israel in their particular social and cultural context. What is more important is the purpose behind the command. And the purpose behind the command was don't get in an economic situation where the poor just get poorer and the rich get richer. There must be equity. Now, obviously, we have all kinds of laws surrounding the lending of money and the way banks can lend money and so forth, the way you can pay that money back. And so there are the same protections, really, in many ways, as Israel was setting up with this command not to loan. But basically, the point for our story is that it's possible that the owner was actually charging interest, you see. Illegally, according to the law of Moses, he was charging interest. And so what happened is the guy says, okay, take away that illegal interest. Take away all that illegal interest you've been paying, and this is what you should actually owe according to the Old Testament law. So what is the owner going to do? At that point, right? He can't go, no, I want my illegal interest. You know, you can't do that. If you're caught, you know, you're caught with extortion, you don't say, no, I want my money back. It's not fair. When you go to jail, they don't give you all that money that you extorted back if the government can get it back from you. Okay, so that's a possibility that he's removing illegal interest that the master had earlier imposed. The problem with that interpretation is the text says nothing about that, and so it doesn't imply that. Here's the third possibility. He's removing his own exorbitant commission that he had been charging. In other words, maybe he has been skimming off the top, charging much more than he should have, and so he is giving that much back, and that's why the owner is not angry at him. We don't know the answer to that question. We don't know precisely what is going on behind the scenes. Most likely, he has sort of snookered, he's hoodwinked the owner by he's gone around the corner and he's forgiven these debts, and now the owner looks so good in the community he cannot oppose what he's done. Now, okay, so here's the story, the parable. Can we learn anything from this strange story? How do we apply this story? As I told you already, I think I would think in terms of the punishment that this guy should exact on the manager. Well, Jesus certainly thought we could because he told the story. Fortunately, as I said, Jesus keeps on teaching. And so our takeaways, our applications to the story really come from the text itself. Here's sort of, I think, what an overall message is: the keys to success in the business that really counts. You see, it's not the physical businesses of the world that are most important. It's the business that counts, and that is the eternal business of God's kingdom. So what does Jesus do? He takes this strange story, probably a story he knew, or maybe an episode that actually occurred, and he makes application from it. And so if we move on to the episodes that follow, or the teaching that follows, we can see Jesus' particular application. Look at what he says. Again, verse 8. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. Now, there is a telling statement by Jesus. The people of this world, he said, are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. Literally, that says the people of this age. This age, that is the present evil age in which we live, can be more shrewd than us as Christians. Unfortunately, Christians often settle for second best, I think. And they often do it in the name of spirituality. Maybe this is less of a problem today than it used to be, but there's certainly a time, and still to a certain extent, where it just doesn't seem very spiritual to talk about money. I know churches that would never hire a business manager. That's just too secular. I was actually involved with a church who the business manager, kind of a part-time person who had been in the church for years and years, was extorting money for years and years, thousands and thousands of dollars. And everyone there, they had sort of, that's funny, but it just didn't seem, you know, right to question a fellow believer on financial matters. And so this went on and on for years. Because Christians, we just shouldn't be involved in the worldly things, in business affairs. And Jesus says, you know, in many ways, unbelievers are more shrewd in dealing with God's resources, the resources of this world, than believers are. The phrase, worldly wealth there, for the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing. Oh, it's the next verse. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends. That's literally, if you want to call it literal, it's the mammon of unrighteousness. The mammon is a word that means, it's an Aramaic word, the language that Jesus spoke, and it's a word that means that all that you own, all that you have, the resources available to you. And unrighteous doesn't mean it was unrighteously earned. In other words, it was earned by cheating. It means the world's wealth. Well, that's why they translate it that way, isn't it? The worldly wealth. So there you go. Good translation. The worldly wealth. Use worldly wealth wisely. Too often, Christians use this sense of spirituality to do a half-baked job or not to excel in what they do. When I was ministering in a college ministry years ago, we had a guy in our college group, and he was sort of a street person. He was, but he wasn't. I mean, he was in and out. He was going to school at times. He'd stay with people in the group. He'd live with people in the group. I think probably in the course of the time I was there, someone gave him, or over the course of the time, different people gave him three cars at different occasions so he could get to work and get back. And he, I really kind of admired the guy. He sort of was lived off the land, you know, sort of a pioneer spirit. He actually slept most of the time out in the woods somewhere, and he'd come to the youth group, and, you know, in many ways seemed like a very spiritual, godly kind of a guy. People would help him. People would get him in jobs. And once, I know some people got him a great job. It was a wonderful job. And he was starting to work at this job, and we thought, maybe this is it. Maybe this is the time he's going to get on his feet. He's going to get his life together. He's going to become responsible. And so one Wednesday night, he shows up at Wednesday night church. He was there on Sunday. I'd seen him on Sunday. He shows up at Wednesday night church, and I said to him, "Don't you have to work tonight?" He goes, "You know what? They wouldn't let me off to come to church on Wednesday night. So I quit," he said. And I thought, "You quit? You quit? Well, you know, what kind of example are you demonstrating to the world when you quit? You came Sunday morning. It's not like they've taken away, you know, your freedom to worship or something like that." But you see, in a sense, he was using that spirituality as an excuse to just kind of do a half-baked job. We as Christians need to be the best at what we do. We need to demonstrate what it means of God's excellence. I love going to Europe and seeing the great cathedrals in Europe. Sadly, most of them are empty or mostly empty these days for lack of people worshiping there. But you can see in the Middle Ages where they put their resources. Where they put their money? You come in and it's this magnificent, magnificent cathedral. And they hired the best craftsmen, you know, the best artists to decorate. And you see that all of it was focused on how do we take our resources and use them to glorify God. Christians should be the absolutely best at what they do. They should excel. They should demonstrate to the world what excellence is all about. Here's our first takeaway. Success in God's business comes from acting shrewdly with the resource we have been given. We should be as entrepreneurial as Bill Gates, as inventive as Thomas Edison, you know, as innovative as Steve Jobs, in the Apple CEO, right? With all of the we as Christians need to be constantly thinking, how can we accomplish God's work more effectively? How can we do it in a more active, a better way? Think about Jesus. Jesus was a carpenter, right? That word actually means craftsman. In fact, some people think Jesus probably worked more with stone than actually wood. But in any case, he was a craftsman. Do you think Jesus built shoddy furniture? You think Jesus, you know, he always had his head in the books, never could really focus on his work. I doubt it. Right? Jesus was a person of excellence. And we are to be people of excellence in all that we do. Think of the internet. I remember when the internet first came on, some pastors were going, oh my goodness, worldly. And it's true. The internet is horribly worldly. And then pastors realized they could put their sermons on the internet each week. You know, so if their people were sick or home in bed, they could actually watch them or hear their sermon. All my father's sermons are now on the internet. My father's with the Lord, but there's a website called Spiritual Gold. Write it down. Spiritual Gold, right, Mom? Your mom runs it, in fact. The server's in the basement of her house. Right? Spiritualgold.org. And thousands of sermons from 30 years of ministry are on there. You can go.
It's free.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Mom. Yeah. A little advertising. Yeah. It's free. Yeah. 10% discount for all those who sign up today for that free. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Technology. Where was I again? I'm going to lose. Yeah. If it's not scallops, it's Mom. You know? It's, yeah. Internet is a great resource for these guys. Think, mom gets letters from missionaries around the globe. I mean, every Sunday morning they can listen, you know, and hear dad speak and preach God's word. So we need to look around and see how can we use the world's resources to accomplish God's purpose. Think about Paul, the Apostle Paul. If Paul were here today, I know he'd have a little iPad, you know, and he'd have cell phones for Titus and Timothy. He'd be in contact with them, right? And he'd be in video conference every evening, you know? The letter to the Romans would have been written in one night. He would have just hammered that thing out and then shot it to all the churches, you know? Because Paul was thinking, how can we most effectively get the gospel to a lost world? I think this also relates to how we do ministry in the community. How we connect. We have to look at where is the world around us? How can we be relevant to them? I remember when Christian music began to go rock and roll, you know, when it began to get more contemporary. Some people really, really rebelled against that. And I was talking to one youth pastor, and they just had a concert, kind of a Christian rock concert. And someone was really upset about this. And he said, would you rather we just bore the kids? You know, church doesn't have to be boring. It can be relevant. It can connect to the world around them. Now, it's true. We could just entertain, and that would be wrong. But if we entertain and then connect people through relevance with the gospel message, don't get me wrong. We need to preach the gospel. But we need to preach the gospel in relevant ways. That's exactly what Paul did. Paul, here's a word we use a lot in seminary. He contextualized the gospel. He took that gospel message and he took the kernel, the essence of that gospel message, and he presented it in different cultural contexts, clearly and accurately in those different cultural contexts. Let me just give you two examples here. Acts chapter 13. We don't need to turn there. You can turn there later if you'd like. Acts 13, Paul, this is the first in Acts. This is the first synagogue sermon that Paul preaches. He goes into the synagogue, of course, where the Jews were. Paul was a Jew. The Old Testament is the Jewish scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures. So what's the first thing Paul does when he goes into a synagogue? He connects them to their roots. He connects them to the Old Testament. And so that's exactly what he does. He preaches a sermon to these Jews in Antioch in Acts 13. He says, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob made a promise to them. And that promise he again made to King David, that one day he would raise up a king from David's line, from David's descendants. And through that king, through that Messiah, he would bring salvation to the world. And you see, the Jews in that synagogue immediately connected because they were children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. King David was their great hero. These were the very scriptures that they used. And so what does Paul do? He goes in there and he connects them directly to what they can understand, what is relevant to them. Some of you probably know where I'm going here. A few chapters later, Paul goes into Athens. Athens, these Greek philosophers of Athens, and he's taken up to a place called Mars Hill, or the Areopagus. And he has to preach another sermon. You couldn't even call it a sermon. They wouldn't know what a sermon was. A lecture. He was going to give a philosophical lecture to these philosophers on Mars Hill. And he can't start with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He can't start with King David. He can't mention the Messiah because they have no idea when any of this is. And so he starts talking. And he says, hey, by the way, as I was walking through Athens, I saw an altar dedicated to an unknown God. Let me tell you who that unknown God is. And he connects them to the God who created the heavens and the earth. You see, same central message, same essential salvation message, same gospel. What's the gospel? The gospel is that we are really messed up, that human beings are fallen and sinful, and we live in a fallen world. But God has stepped in to bring us salvation through faith in him, through trust in him. You can tell that gospel message in any context in the world, any cultural, historical context in the world. It's about contextualizing the gospel, bringing it into a context where people can truly understand. I want you to hold your place in Luke. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians real quick. I want to show you one passage where Paul describes his missionary philosophy. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. In verse 19 of 1 Corinthians chapter 9, go forward from where we are in the Gospels to Acts, Romans, 1 Corinthians. 9:19, though I am free and belong to no one, I make myself a slave to everyone, to win as many as possible. Here it comes. To the Jews I became a Jew, to win the Jews. To those under the law I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak I became weak to win the weak. Here it is, I become all things to all people so that by all possible means, there it is, I might save some. I do this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. See, Paul says, I will do anything to make this gospel clear and relevant to those who desperately need to hear the message of salvation. Elsewhere, Jesus says it this way. He says, be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves. We don't compromise the gospel. We find ways to connect. Ways to connect. Never by deception. That's what's crucial here. Never by false motives. We've got to be incredibly creative, I think. We should be constantly thinking, how does this latest cultural fad or cultural thing connect to the gospel? How can I share God's love with people who've never heard it before? Okay, so act shrewdly with the resources we've been given. Jesus draws a second application then from this passage. Verse 9, I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Jesus says, focus on your eternal destination. This man, what is he doing? This unrighteous steward, he is preparing his retirement account, isn't he? right? He's thinking, okay, don't have a lot of savings. I don't have an IRA. I don't have a 401k. What am I going to do? I've just been fired. I know what I do. I'll prepare my retirement savings. I'll make friends with people who can welcome me into their home. Jesus says, hey, think about what this guy's doing. Think about what this guy's doing. He realized he doesn't have a future in his present job. I have to tell everyone here, hear this. You don't have a future in your present job. Okay? It's only going to last maybe another 50 years at the most. You don't have a. There is no future in our present job. There is no future in this present world. It's about eternity. So Jesus says, think about what this guy's doing. He's thinking ahead. Thinking ahead, preparing for an uncertain future. I mentioned before that I used to live in the South. I was raised in the South. And we'd love to drive, when we traveled around in the South, we loved to go in the little curio shops, you know, and we'd find this stuff. Confederate money. So great. You can get $1 million in Confederate money, you know, for a couple dollars. Confederate money worth, during the years of the Civil War, worth a lot. The Southern states started to print this money. But think if you were become wealthy during the days of the Civil War, you had $1 million in Confederate money. And slowly you recognize the war is coming to an end. You're going to lose. The South is losing the war. What would you do with all of your Confederate money? Burn it. No, don't. Oh. Convert it. That's right. Convert it. Buy land, right? Buy some real estate. Buy property. Invest in something that's going to last beyond the world. What's the point? The point is it's all Confederate money, right? All the money we have is going to pass away. John Ortberg. In fact, there's a resource on your back that's from John Ortberg. It says, when the game is over, it all goes back in the box. I'm going to read you a little story. This is from John Ortberg from that book called by that same name. He says, there's an analogy that comes from the world of games. I first learned it from my grandmother. My grandmother taught me how to play the game Monopoly. Now, my grandmother was a wonderful person. She raised 6 children. She was a widow by the time I knew her well. She lived in our house for many, many years. But she was a lovely woman, and she was a lovely woman, but she was the most ruthless Monopoly player I've ever known. Imagine what would have happened if Donald Trump had married Leona Helmsley and they would have had children. Then you have some picture of what my grandmother was like when she played Monopoly. She understood that the name of the game is to acquire. When we would play when I was a little kid and I got my money from the bank, I would always want to save it, hang on to it, because it was just so much fun to have money. She spent on everything she landed on. And then when she bought it, she would mortgage it as much as she could and buy everything else she landed on. She would accumulate everything she could, and eventually she became the master of the board. And every time I landed, I would have to pay her money. And eventually, every time she would take my last dollar, I would quit in utter defeat. And then she would always say the same thing to me. She'd look at me and she'd say, one day you'll learn how to play this game. I hated it when she said that to me, but one summer I played Monopoly with a neighborhood kid, a friend of mine, almost every day, all day long. We'd play Monopoly for hours. And that summer, I learned to play the game. I came to understand the only way to win is to make a total commitment to acquisition. I came to understand that money and possessions, that's the way that you keep score. And by the end of the summer, I was more ruthless than my grandmother. I was ready to bend the rules if I had to win that game. And I sat down with her to play that fall. Slowly, cunningly, there's our word, I exposed my grandmother's vulnerabilities. Relentlessly, inexorably, I drove her off the board. The game does strange things to you. I can still remember. It happened at Marvin Gardens. I looked at my grandmother. She taught me how to play the game. She was an old lady by now. She was a widow. She had raised my mom. She loved my mom. She loved me. I took everything she had. I destroyed her financially and psychologically. I watched her give her last dollar and quit in utter defeat. It was the greatest moment of my life. And then she had one more thing to teach me. Then she said, now it all goes back in the box. All those houses and those hotels, all the railroads and utility companies, all that property and all that wonderful money, now it all goes back in the box. I didn't want it to go back in the box. I wanted to leave the board out, bronze it maybe, as a memorial to my ability to play the game. No, she said, none of it was really yours. You got all heated up about it for a while. but it was around a long time before you sat down at the board, and it will be here after you're gone. Players come and players go, but it all goes back in the box. And the game always ends. For every player, the game ends. Every day you pick up a newspaper, and you can turn to a page that describes people for whom this week the game ended. Skilled businessmen, an aging grandmother who was in a convalescent home with a brain tumor, teenage kids who think they have the whole world in front of them, and somebody drives through a stop sign. It all goes back in the box. Houses and cars, titles and clothes, filled barns, bulging portfolios, even your body. It all goes back in the box. Paul says it this way. He says, "For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of the world." We brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of the world. All we take out of the world is our relationship with God and our relationship with others. Here's our second takeaway. Success in God's business comes from planning ahead for the inevitable future. I've heard a story. I don't know if it's quite true. Do we have any undertakers here? Any morticians here? I've heard that they make suits, clothing, specifically for undertakers, for people to be buried in. A little bit cheaper, but something that looks really nice. But in those suits that they make for undertakers, there are no pockets. Right? The pockets are all just sewn on the front. Whether it's true or not, there's a great story there. You can't possibly take it with you. There's no reason to have pockets in that clothing. Because all that we earn here, all that we save, all that we buy, all that we invest in, we leave here. Remember the story, the parable of the narrow door. What happens? The guy comes knocking. He comes knocking and knocking. And the host comes, and remember what he says? He says, "I never knew you. I never knew you." This man is making friends so that when the day comes, he can come knocking at the door. And they will say, "Welcome, you saved us. You cut that interest in half. You saved our farm. Welcome, you're our friend forever, our friend for life." Matthew 6, 19 and 21, a great verse that summarizes this. "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal." We've seen that verse a lot in Luke's gospel. We've turned to it a lot in Luke's gospel because Luke's gospel is all about how do we get an eternal perspective. Two quick points. Trustworthiness will be rewarded with greater trust. Look at verse 10. "Whoever can be trusted with very little can be trusted with much. Whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much." So if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you've not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? Great principle here. Trustworthiness in the little things. When God gives us responsibility, if we're trustworthy in that, we'll be trustworthy in the greater things. One of my kids used to really like the movie Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. This was the old one, the Gene Wilder one. Of course, there was a new one with Johnny Depp. I don't know if you saw the old one, saw the new one. But the great story of Willy Wonka, it's a story about being trustworthy with the little. If you haven't heard the story of the first one doesn't quite follow the book as much as the second one. But I love the way the first one ends. The story, Willy Wonka, the great chocolatier, right, owns the chocolate factory. But in the past, he's had opponents, especially a guy named Arthur Slugworth, who've tried to swindle him, steal his secrets. So Willy Wonka gives a great big event where he gives away free tickets, golden tickets, hidden in candy bars. And only 5 lucky children can get those tickets. And those 5 lucky children will then get a tour of the chocolate factory and will get a lifetime supply of chocolate. 4 of those kids are spoiled kids in all different areas. One of them is Charlie, of course. Charlie, the original book was called Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And as they take the tour of the chocolate factory, one by one, each of the kids misbehaves in some ways and meets some terrible end, some terrible destruction of some kind. Only Charlie survives to the end. But in the Gene Wilder version, in the original one, Charlie also breaks one of the rules. And I forgot, prior to this, Arthur Slugworth had found Charlie, and he said, "Look, I want you to get a particular candy. Willy Wonka has invented the most amazing piece of candy. It's called an everlasting God stopper, which is very symbolic, right? An everlasting, that candy you can suck on forever. If you get me one of those, I'll give you incredible wealth. I'll give you all this money. So Willy Wonka gives each of the children one of these candies. And so Charlie knows that he can give this candy if he wants. He can give it to Arthur Slugworth, and he can become absolutely wealthy. So he gets to the end of the tour, and he thinks he's going to get lifetime supply of chocolate. And Willy Wonka says, no, you broke the rules. You broke the rules, so you get nothing. You can just leave now. And at that point, Charlie has a decision. He can take that candy. He can take that candy, and he can go out and leave and become wealthy by giving it to Willy Wonka's rival, Arthur Slugworth. But instead, what he does is, as Willy Wonka is sitting at his desk, he comes and he puts the candy down on the desk, and then he walks out. And just as he does, Willy Wonka, the great moment in the movie, Willy Wonka turns around and he says, Charlie, wait. He said, you passed the test. You see, the test was he was looking for someone to take over the chocolate factory, to run the chocolate. He was looking for one honest kid, one kid with integrity. A very little act, right? A small thing to say, I'm not going to take that candy with me. I'm not going to use it to deceive. I'm not going to use it to exploit, to defeat Willy Wonka. So those who are faithful with a little, Jesus says, will be faithful with much. God has given each of us responsibilities in this world. He's given each of us roles to play. And when we're responsible with those things, God's going to give us even greater responsibility. Here's a few areas. Christians need to be responsible in the little things. Here's an example. Tell the truth all the time, not just when it's convenient to do so. Be honest. Sometimes it's easy to tell a little white lie just to get out of a particular situation, even to a fault. Be courteous and friendly, even to that salesperson who's snippety. You ever get one of those? Keep the appointments you make. Pay bills on time. When you sell something, disclose its flaws. If you sell that car, you know you're going to get a little more if you don't tell them about that noise, or that the window doesn't go down, or that the locks don't quite work. Only live life to a higher standard. I love those Hebrew National commercials, you know, where they say, we answer to a higher call. We have higher standard than even the Federal Drug or the Federal Food Administration there. Here's a quote from Fred Craddock on this passage. He says, most of us will not this week christen a ship, write a book, end a war, appoint a cabinet, dine with the queen, convert a nation, or be burned at the stake. Most likely the week will present no more than a chance to give a cup of water, write a note, visit a nursing home, vote for a county commissioner, teach a Sunday school class, share a meal, tell a child a story, go to choir practice, and feed the neighbor's cat. All little things, but little things that count for eternity. Finally, verse 13 sums it all up. No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. And there's our final takeaway. Success in business comes from serving the only master who really counts. Focusing our resources on things that have eternal value. The great preacher John Wesley said this about money. We would expect a negative attitude about money. He said this about money. He said, make all you can, save all you can, give all you can. Invest all you can for eternity. God calls us to excellence. And whatever career and whatever position you're in, if you're a lawyer, if you're a banker, if you're a plumber, if you're a carpenter, whatever God has called you to, God calls us to excellence. God calls us to demonstrate around us kingdom values and reveal his purpose to the world. The ultimate question is, who are you serving? Where are those resources going? Is it going to go for things that last for eternity, or go for things that are only temporal? Let me close our time together in prayer, and then I'll take, if we have any questions, we have a little bit of time for questions. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for this strange and bizarre parable that shocks us at first, but then we hear that you draw just amazing principles about what it means to serve you, what it means to be your people, what it means to live with the resources of this world to accomplish your purpose. Lord, I pray that we would hear you speak today, and that we would act on that, that we would, Lord, practice excellence and practice integrity in all areas of our lives. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, I saw at least one hand. Yeah, probably.
So when Jesus says, "Create for yourself treasures in heaven," he's kind of saying, even though you can't take it with you, you can send it ahead.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a great way to put it. Yeah, even though you can't send it with you, you can send it ahead. Yeah, ultimately the treasures that count. Yes.
Okay, so what about retirement, saving up for retirement and dealing with, you know, the things you have to deal with here
right.
in life?
Right. Well, you know, and I think the passage is talking about being practical with the world's resources. What's going to happen if you don't save up for retirement, if you don't put aside some, if you're not responsible with what you have, you're going to be a burden to someone else. You're going to create problems either for family or whatever. So this is what Jesus means when he says, be shrewd as serpents. We need to think in terms of how can I best use my resources to accomplish God's purpose throughout my whole life. And part of that life is retirement. Now, if retirement is solely for your pleasure, if you're not focused on God's purposes, then I think there's problems we can get into. We can certainly put too much into retirement and not invest enough in what God is doing. But I think responsible living with our finances is a great principle. I mean, Jesus says, you know, use worldly wealth wisely. He doesn't say give it all away so that you don't, you know, you then become a burden to others. I don't know if that's any other questions. They can be about this passage or other areas. This is a chance sometimes to deal with those hard questions in the Bible or hard questions of theology. Anything else?
Two little words of wisdom. One, you can't outgive the Lord, and God always makes it right.
Mm-hmm. And secondly?
God
always makes it right. You can't outgive, I don't know if you all heard that, you can't outgive the Lord. That is absolutely right. People who give the most tend to have the most blessings in their life. And God always makes it right. God always meets our needs. He has the resources to meet our needs. Great wisdom. Thank you. All right. We will see you
Thanks very much,
next
Mark.
Week. Yeah.